Dear friends, we extend you a warm welcome to the ULT for this evening's talk on the subject, the meaning of death and purpose of life. Let's prepare our mind with an appropriate devotional reading from the first part of the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, entitled Devotion by Means of Discrimination of the Kshetra from Kshetrajna. Krishna. This perishable body, O son of Kunti, is known as Kshetra. Those who are acquainted with the true nature of things knows it the Kshetrajna. Know also that I am the knower in every mortal body, O son of Bharata. That knowledge which through the soul is a realization of both the known and the knower is alone esteemed by me as wisdom. What the kshetra or body is, what it resembleth, what it produceth, and what is its origin, and also who he is, who dwelling within knoweth it, as well as what is his power, learn all in brief from me. It hath been manifoldly sung by the rishis with discrimination and with argument in the various Vedic hymns which treat of Brahma. This body then is made up of things: ahankara, egotism, buddhi, intellect or judgment, the unmanifest invisible spirit, the 10 centers of action, the mind, and the 5 objects of the senses: desire, aversion, pleasure and pain, persistency of life, and firmness, the power of cohesion. Thus I have made known unto thee what the kshetra or body is with its component parts. True wisdom of a spiritual kind is freedom from self-esteem, hypocrisy, injury to others. It is patience, sincerity, respect for spiritual instructors, purity, firmness, self-restraint, dispassion for objects of sense, freedom from pride, and a meditation upon birth, death, sickness and error. It is an exemption from self-identifying attachment for children, wife and household, and a constant unwavering steadiness of heart upon the arrival of every event, whether favorable or unfavorable. It is a never-ceasing love for me alone, the self being effaced and worship being paid in a solitary spot, and a want of pleasure in congregation of men. It is a resolute continuance in the study of Adhyatma, the Supreme Spirit, Superior Spirit, and a meditation upon the end of the acquirement of knowledge of truth. This is called wisdom or spiritual knowledge. Its opposite is ignorance. Now, meaning of death and the purpose of life. We go through life experiencing very common things of life, events and processes, and we take them all for granted. We never question them, what they are, what they mean. Take for instance our going to sleep. In the night we go to sleep, in the morning we wake, and during sleep we have dreams, and we go to a very deep sleep, and then again wake. We never question why, what is this sleep, why this dream, what do they mean, how do they occur. We never question it. And then take life itself. We know we are living. We scarcely question what life is. We all know we have mind. We scarcely question what exactly is mind. Of course, science has some theories about mind, but is it true? Science may say, well, it is a product of the brain. There are many other phenomena of mind, and especially paranormal phenomena, which that theory of science that it is a product of the brain does not hold good. So, death. What is death? We scarcely question what death is. Now, when you mention in social circles or family circles the subject of death, there is some sort of aversion. People don't like to talk of death. In fact, they consider the subject of death, discussion of subject of death, to be inauspicious. And there is fear of death. I remember an old lady in our family circle. When death occurred in the neighborhood, though far away from home, she would close all the windows and doors and sit inside, as if death is a beast that will come and pounce and eat. And I've seen also others who, having received a message of death, you know, from someone, though the person may be far related or maybe even acquaintance, then they will immediately change the clothes, go and have bath. The very mention of death is considered to be unclean, and it instills a fear in them, and they would like to cleanse themselves. So these are the common reactions of people to death. They consider it to be a very inauspicious subject. They don't like to discuss it, especially in old traditional societies like India. But of course, in the Western world, they take it in a very open-minded way. But in the traditional societies, a lot of taboos are attached to it, and a lot of beliefs and customs and rituals are attached to death. But generally speaking, in the social circles, especially in traditional societies, the subject of death is considered to be inauspicious. It is avoided. And yet, what does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita? He says, he enumerates 20 virtues to be the marks of spiritual wisdom, and of the 20, one is the meditation upon death, birth, decay, sickness and error. One has to meditate on that and not get scared or considered inauspicious and run away or turn away from it. It is to be investigated, it must be understood. After all, death is also a phenomenon of life. So we take all this for granted, we never question these things. And yet there are wonderful thinkers who do not conform to such taboos and superstitious fear question. To my mind, one such comes to my mind, I recollect one great American thinker called Felix Adler. He lived between 1851 to 1933, a wonderful independent thinker, and he was a professor of political and social ethics. He was a publisher and founder of the American Ethical Cultural Movement, an independent thinker. Though he was born in Orthodox Jewish community, he never conformed to the Orthodox views of religious views of life and death. He emphasized the important point that ultimately it is not the rituals, it is not mere beliefs or belief in God or something like that which is save mankind, but it is in following ethical laws of life. That's the only basis by which humanity can realize its interdependence and essential unity. He worked to that end. He wrote a book called Life and Destiny, and he discusses the question of death there. He says, in death, there is message of life. So he said that let us from the lips of death learn the lessons of life. That was the theme of his book. I tried to locate that book in Amazon, but it is out of print. It is not available, it seems. It is worth getting the books of books written by this great author. And there are a lot of points for meditation on you know, how we must live ethical life and our duty to the society and to the nation and to the world, and we must live up to that responsibility. That was his theme. And he discusses all this questions of life and death. So let's learn, from the lips of death lessons of life. That was his message. And now let's see what Nachiketa, he was another unusual person who questioned life. Not only questioned life, he had thought about it, and he didn't accept death to be inevitable. So he went, you know, his thought went beyond the mere popular notions of death and how we can overcome it. His whole search was how we can overcome death. And let's see what his line of thinking and his search in two verses in. He says to Yama, the god of death, in heaven world there is no fear at all, and you're not there. The god of death is not in the heaven world, and in the heavenly abode there is no fear of old age, and there is no torment of thirst and hunger. And these two streams, rivers of thirst and hunger, are crossed over in the heaven world, and the denizens of the heaven live happily. O god of death, you know the secret of the heavenly flame, heavenly fire, and how that heavenly flame and heavenly fire can be gotten hold of. You teach me that. That is the aspiration of a free thinker and a bold searcher for truth. So we must go beyond mere conventional beliefs and search for the meaning of all these important events of life. Now, what do the popular religions say? When we speak of the views of popular religion on this question of death, we must know that this is the view of the conventional organized, the views of the organized religion, not the true religious views as originally extant. Then we must remember that. Now, if you take into consideration the Abrahamic religion, from which have come Christianity, Islam, what do they say? They say, you know, their theory is that for every child born, God makes a soul, and it lives its life in the world and then ultimately dies. And when the person dies, the soul does not die, and that the according to the belief of the Christian church, the soul will either go to heaven, which is eternal, or go to hell, which again is eternal without an end, to be tormented in heaven without end, or go to heaven, which also has no end, to enjoy the heavenly felicity, depending upon whether you adhered to the dogma proclaimed by the church that Jesus shed his blood on the cross. This is a view of Christian religion. What do the Islamists say? The same thing, that for every newborn baby there's a new soul made. God makes a soul. And then living the life of full life on the earth, then depending upon its deeds, a little different from what Christians say, whether good or evil, and the person dies, he goes into, you know, a state of either hell or heaven, depending upon his deeds. And after, at the end of the life of the universe, they call it a judgment day, and the souls are brought up, and then judgment is pronounced, how he has lived his life, and then the soul is condemned to hell if it has done bad, or it goes into heaven, or given the heavenly felicity if it has done good. So this is the belief of the organized religions, but not necessarily the true teachings of the original religious teachings. Now, for instance, if you go to the Gnostics, who are the true esoteric Christian tenets, they do not speak of all this. Neither Jesus Christ ever spoke of such heaven and hell that one would repair it after the end of the life. He never taught this. But this is only a dogma of the church. If you go to the original source of Christianity, it is not there. But the whole tenets will be more rational and reasonable. Of that we will see a little later. And then similarly, if you go to the Sufi saints, they differ from what the Orthodox Islamists say. They do not speak of eternal heaven and eternal hell. And many of the Sufi saints do keep their minds open, and they speak of reincarnation. Now, coming to what is the theosophical view? What is the theosophical view of death? That is best understood, best represented in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, whatever is born, death is certain. Janmasya dhruvam mrityuhu. Janmasya, for whatever is born, death is certain. And dhruvam janma mrityasya cha. So whatever ends, whatever dies, rebirth is certain. It is the same thing as saying that at the end of the day, it is certain that the sun sets. And at the same time, at the beginning of another day, it is as certain that the sun will rise. So when the sun sets, when the sun blazes throughout the day, he sets. That is inevitable. But that is not the end. He rises again. You look at the seasons. The whole seasons go from spring and then summer, autumn, winter. And when the winter comes, the seasons do not end there. It goes through the cycle again. So in the conception of ancients and the conception of theosophy, the whole life events are cyclic. So law of cycles, law of periodicity is the fundamental law of, this is one of the most important tenet of the ancient wisdom. So we wake every morning from sleep, and we have our day activity, and again go to sleep. When you go to sleep, that's not the end, we wake again. Similarly, when the life ends, that is not the end. When sun sets, he rises again, so do the person who dies has another rebirth. So it is a law of cycles. The law of periodicity. What was there before comes again now. What is now will come again at the end of the end of its term. So this wheel rotates continuously. And we must remember that the whole life, the whole universe is pervaded by duality. There is day and night. There is good and evil. There is pleasure and pain, happiness and sorrow. There is centripetal force and centrifugal force. If this were not so, if the whole life were not made of pairs of opposites, there would not be existence at all. There would not be life at all. How would we know light if sunlight? How would we ever experience the warmth of the sunlight if we did not know the darkness and the cold of the night? It is only through the contrast of the opposite that we experience the contrast of the light, which is darkness. It is only through the contrast of the light, which is darkness, we understand what light is. And the shades between life and light and darkness, we understand only through contrasts. So this pairs of opposites we experience, it is through this comparison that we learn and experience life, and from the experience we learn. So this is a very important point that we must remember, that when we say that when life ends, there is another life, another birth take place, there is something known as spiritual law of continuity. There are two very important things we must remember. One is spiritual law of continuity and the law of conservation of energy. Take the example of, you know, we have gone through life, this, you know, personal life, through earlier years of childhood, youth, and then we have reached middle age, and then we go to old age. Things have changed. And all our thoughts and actions, we have produced tremendous amount of energy. And are they lost? No, they're not lost. Every action, every thought and feeling of ours is not lost. The voice of the silence says, even wasted smoke remains not traceless. Every word uttered, every thought that flashes from our mind, it is an energy. Energy is never destroyed. Conservation of energy, it remains. And spiritual law of continuity. Though we have gone through all these changes right from childhood, our body has changed, our thoughts and ideas have changed, our interests have changed, but the ego, the experiencer, the person who is going through the change has not changed at all. The self-identity, in other words, self-identity remains unchanged. If we had not this self-identity, unchanging self-identity, we would never have any experience of life. We would not ever remember anything, any of the event of the past, nor would we make anything, any meaning out of life. So this principle of self-identity and law of kanji and law of cycles, if you meditate upon this and make, you know, take these axioms and reflect upon life's mysteries, many a riddle of life can be made, it becomes clear to us. Now, look at this idea of self-identity. We have gone through all these changes, but we remain changeless. So we go through sleep and waking and dream, and we come back to waking again, but the self-identity remains the same. Similarly, the self-identity does not alter, does not get destroyed, does not get dissipated when we, at the termination of this life on earth, end our life, drop the body, and during the intervening period also, it doesn't change, and we are reborn, the same self-identity continues. It's the principle of self-identity. Now, this we can understand by taking the example of moon. The moon, the phases the moon undergoes. To begin with, you know, when the beginning of the fortnight, it begins with a crescent moon, then it becomes half moon, and then three-fourths moon, and the full moon. And when the full moon, again, it becomes gibbous moon, that is three-fourths, and then half moon, and then crescent moon, and disappears. So moon is continuously undergoing this change of phases. Now the question is the moon undergoing the change of phases? Or we are only We only think that it is undergoing the change of phases. We think the moon is undergoing the phase of changes, this change of phases, because of our particular situation on Earth in relation to the moon and the relative moment. It produces the illusion that moon is changing its phases. Similarly, sun. In the evening sun sets, in the morning sun rises. Does sun really set and rise? It is because, it is an illusion produced because of our situation relative to the sun and the earth and the relative movement of the two. It produces that illusion. In the same way that the phase of the moon doesn't affect the moon itself, remains changeless. In the same way that the rising and the setting of the sun doesn't affect the sun itself, it is only an appearance because of our appearance of our perceptive faculties. Similarly, our birth and death are only appearance. The self-identity doesn't change. Another food for thought we must keep in mind and keep this in mind and always meditate upon. Another important point we can we must keep in mind. What do we mean by death in the ordinary parlance? What do we mean by death? Death means disintegration, right? Death of anything, of a plant or animal body or physical body, of anything, any object, is destruction. This we call as death. So death means destruction of the organized form. Death of a destruction of an organized form, it disintegrates into atoms. But the atoms themselves, each one of the atom is the indestructible. And what are atoms? They're energy. Energy is indestructible. Matter is indestructible. So is self-identity, which is spiritually indestructible. So the indestructible atoms aggregate together to make form as a dwelling for the spirit to indwell and experience. The forms change, they are aggregated, they are disintegrated. But the dweller in the form which is aggregated, he experiences them. At the end of the life, he is disintegrated, the dweller in the form is expelled. He gets another form. The conditions and qualities and tendencies and all the circumstances in which the new form is made depends upon what the dweller did in the previous existence. Depending upon the causes that he generated, the new form that is produced as a result of those effects, a new form is made, another dwelling is made to the self-identity. So, for all this, self is unaffected by all these changes. But birth and death pertains to form, not to the self. This is another point that we must bear in mind. And yet, another important, we must always bear in mind the nature of our self-identity, the I in us, the I am I consciousness in us. We usually, associate I am I consciousness with the body. When we say I, we see this body. So this I that we are familiar with which, the egotism, is only a part of the real I. The real I rises above the conditions and circumstances of the body. And the real I is bodiless, the higher I, the higher manas. And that real I is our true self-identity. In other words, I am I consciousness is our mind being. This mind being, during its embodiment, takes on a dual aspect. Only a portion of the real mind assumes the form which is aggregated together and becomes the egotism, lower I, caught up in passions and desires, and it is the actor and the thinker. But the higher I remains unaffected above, and his onlooker, he is the witness. In the Upanishad speak of two birds in a tree. One bird sits in the lower branches and feeds upon the seeds and the fruits. The other bird sits above the higher branches and watches it. So our real higher I is a watcher. Though it does not incarnate into the form, still it works through its alter ego and takes on the consequences of the doings of the alter ego to itself. This must be understood, this dual nature of mind. If these principles are, if this axiomatic truths are borne in mind, it will shed light on all the mysteries of life. Now, we have spoken of this number of times, law of conservation of energy. At the end of the life, there's a separation of the good from the evil. All the lower thoughts and gross energies of the selfish affairs of life, you know, greed, anger, selfishness, our concern with material life, is one kind of psychic energy we are generating, and it is indestructible. At the same time, we also have our higher aspirations, higher thoughts, nobler feelings. This is another kind of spiritual kind. At the time of death, these two separate. And the higher ego takes only the essence of our noblest thoughts and aspirations of love, of compassion, of kindness, concern for others. Our undying thoughts become assimilated to the higher ego. And there it is assimilated in a spiritual condition. And again, law of conservation of energy ensures, according to that law, all this is not lost. So these produce innumerable effects and converge into a new circumstances in which the ego is drawn back to another life. So nothing is lost. Now, Theosophy teaches, you know, there is so much of fear about death, and according to the materialist teaching, death means the end of the man. According to science, man is just an animal body, and when the death occurs, means that's all over, that nothing remains. This is the reason why there is so much of fear of death in the mind of people. This is not the only thing. As already said, the religions, exoteric, orthodox religion, fear in the people. Look, when you die, you'll be tortured in hell. So there's fear of death. But this is all ignorance. So we were read in the Bhagavad Gita, if you have the spiritual wisdom, this kind of a fear based on ignorance will disappear. Death, Theosophy teaches, comes as a deliverer and friend. So in life, in embodied life, we meet with the effects we generated in the past, all the, you know, the inharmonious, discordant actions which we consider as evil, which does much disharmony in the world, which violates the laws of harmony, brings its effects as so much of pain and sorrow to us in life. Much of the bulk of life is consists of sorrow and suffering. And when many disappointments, sorrows and suffering comes, we always ask, why this has come to me? Why? What did I deserve to have such misfortunes attend on me? This very thought and so powerful that it produces an effect in your afterlife. And then also, you know, as already said, you have also generated our higher thoughts and higher aspirations. These also produce an effect which we have to reap in the afterlife. So Life is full of suffering, and if life were to continue, you know, all of us like to live long, 100 years, if possible 110 years also. Is it really worth it? All the problems of the old age and misery and sickness. So, death comes to relieve us of this suffering, of the imprisonment in the body, and all the you know, difficulties, which is inevitable. So death comes as a deliverer and a friend. What is not generally known is the fact that when the person dies, immediately after death, he is in the presence of his higher divine consciousness, in which all the events of life are reviewed, and the person sees for himself the absolute justice of all that has transpired in his life, all the suffering that came to him, and he is filled with the love of the divine. And then the next operation comes to Devakani. So death comes as a deliverer and a friend, and all the suffering that we underwent in life is compensated a hundredfold in what is called the heavenly enjoyment, heavenly felicity, which is nothing but the higher consciousness, all the nobler aspirations that we have taken and are born to our higher divine consciousness. There they are assimilated in bliss, in unadulterated bliss, and which is a, you know, which is a rest and a recuperation and assimilation of all the life's experiences for the ego. So the ego has gone through the life experiences with much suffering, and it is just like, you know, if the ego does not have this kind of a rest and recuperation and felicity, if it were to reborn again, it would become very burdensome. Just like if you do not have enough sleep and go to the work the next day, it becomes a burdensome to you. You will not be able to manage. The same analogy. So the just law provides for rest and recuperation for the ego, and also for compensation for every tear that one shed on earth out of pain and sorrow and disappointment and being subjected to tortures. Every tear of pain that it shed is compensated a hundredfold with corresponding bliss. So death comes as a deliverer and friend. Now, have you answered the question what death is? Still the question remains, what is death? There's a very interesting dialogue between Tra and Sanat Sujata. You know, Krishna says that four kinds of people worship him. Those who are artho, artharthi, jignasu, and jnani. Artho, those who suffer, they go in search of Krishna, wisdom. That's what happened to Dhritarashtra at the end of the Mahabharata war. You know, because of his attachment to his son, all the calamity happened, and he has lost all the 100 sons. He's stricken with sorrow, and he says, what is the purpose of life? He begins to question. And then he asks Dhritarashtra, tell me, what is death and what is after death? Dhritarashtra tells him, look, I am born of a low social strata. I will not tell you. I will invoke Sanata. Only he is competent to answer this question. And then he invokes Sanat Sujata. Very interesting. I'll read a few verses. Now, I will not read the Sanskrit verses, but only translation of the the Sanskrit verses. When Saraswati Sujata appears, Dhritarashtra tells him, "Hey, Saraswati Sujata, you have taught that there is no death. This is your preaching. I have heard it. But gods and demons performed, they lived a life of continuous brahmacharya for 32 years in order to attain immortality. Now, if there is no death, why should they strive for immortality?" What a question he asked. So he says, "Yes, some say that through righteous works one attains to immortality. And others say there is no death at all. Now, I'll tell you the truth. Don't have any doubts. Hey king, both are true. Those who say there is no death, true. Those who say through good works you attain immortality, even that's also true. These two truths have been current from the very beginning of time. I'll tell you, some say, moha, delusion is death." What is moha? Moha is attachment. Attachment and aversion. So we have attachment and aversion for things. When we have attachment and aversion for things, then we do not see things as they are. So this is called moha, delusion. Some say moha, delusion is death. But I tell you, pramada is death. What is pramada? Pramada is forgetfulness of the true self-identity is pramada. I tell you, pramada is death. Pramadam vai mrityam aham bravimi. And always to be aware of the true self, apramada, is immortality. Sada apramadam amritam tattvam bravimi. This is my teaching. And then he goes on to say that through pramada, forgetfulness of self, through carelessness, the asuras lost the battle. But the gods, through vigilance and constant dwelling upon in the self, they won. They became one with the Supreme. And don't think death, mrityu, is like a tiger which will pounce upon you and eat you up. No, it is not like that. The form of death is not known. It is very mysterious. Now, there is another teaching, Saraswati Sujata says. Another teaching is the god of death, Yama, who resides in Buddhi, who is about death, who is intent on Supreme Spirit. Some say, other than not Pramada, but he is the real death, he is Mrityu. And he is the one who ordains good fruits to those who do good, evil fruits to those who do evil. And he is the ruler of the kingdom of the living. This is the opinion of some. Now, I will tell you, Saraswati Sujata says, how the forgetfulness of the self, pramada, gives rise to death. When the forgetfulness of self arises in us, then from that is born ahankara. From that is born egotism, that I am separate from others, that I am different from others, mine and ayin, mine and is I and mine. So this gives rise to anger and hatred and desire and greed, and it becomes moha and delusion, and from this they never attain to the perception of the true self. So due to this ignorance, become deluded, become imprisoned by this delusion, they, after the end of life, they again fall back into another generation. Then when they fall back into another generation, all the senses will gather around them, and they follow after the senses, and again fall into generation, following the dictates of the senses. Now, he says, this delusion produced by the senses, this attachment produced by the senses, is a great deluder, So, this is what attaches the ego to the things evanescent and transitory, mithyartha. So, he follows the dictates of the senses, and it destroys the meditation, and he becomes imprisoned in relativity. First, the attending to the objects of the sense destroy the meditation, and then comes kama and krodha. That is the next thing which destroys man. And these children become slaves of these, and death carries them away. Whereas those in whom discrimination is not destroyed, but they cross over death. And then there is only one way by which you can destroy death. And it teaches this death, which is produced due to ignorance, can be destroyed only through knowledge. One who does not meditate on the object of the sense, who renounces the attachment and aversion for the objects of sense and fruits of his action, he destroys both kama and krodha, and he destroys death itself and becomes the death of death. He attains immortality. This is a beautiful teaching of Sanaschusata. And this is exactly what Saint Paul teaches. It's the same teaching, exactly the same teaching. What Jata is called, the delusion of the senses, Saint Paul calls it corruption. And freedom from this delusion and purification of self, incorruption. It is through this that we overcome death. I'll just read this and then we'll consider some questions. Look at the duality of soul he mentions here. The first man is of the earth, earthly. The second man is of the Lord from heaven. Now this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, neither doth corruption inherit incorruption. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, this mortal must put on immortality. So, when this corruption shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory? So a few thoughts. So if you have any points, questions we can consider. I'm sorry, I took a little longer. Should have closed at 7 itself.